Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the Voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back to the program that is designed to help you learn and improve your American English. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today, we have two very interesting stories to tell you. The first involves violence in Nigeria, as the government announces new non-military ways to control terrorism. Then, we will take you to the United States Capitol building, where some lawmakers say the CIA has been spying on them. Have I gotten your attention? I hope so. As It is on the air from VOA. Nigeria's National Security Advisor recently announced plans for a non-military campaign against Islamist extremists. His goal is to end a 4.5-year-old rebellion that has killed thousands of people. The new campaign would be in addition to, but not replace, military efforts to fight the Islamist group Boko Haram. About 10 months ago, Nigeria launched its biggest military operation ever against Boko Haram and its supporters. The military declared emergency rule in 3 northeastern states. Nigerian forces quickly gained control of large population centers. But the violence continued in rural areas. Recently, northern cities have again come under attack. The non-governmental organization Human Rights Watch says 700 people have been killed this year alone. Sambo Dasuki is Nigeria's national security advisor. He says the government has decided to use new ways to fight Boko Haram.
My approach has been to understand the problem in order to apply the appropriate solutions. What we have learned is that there is not one particular path that leads to terrorism. Rather, there are many, often complicated paths that lead to terrorism.
There are many causes of the Islamist rebellion. Mr. Dasuki says they include poverty, social injustice, and the failure of Islamists to mix with other Nigerians. He says the solutions include prison reform, economic development, peace talks, and education. Under the plan, 2 prisons will become what the government calls de-radicalization centers. The National Security Advisor says the next step is to train people working at the prisons.
The initiative will require substantial capacity building of prison staff in areas such as psychology, sports and arts therapy, faith-based instructors, and vocational training experts that would engage beneficiaries.
He says another way to fight the growth of Boko Haram is through reforming the economy in northeastern Nigeria. Many people who live there are very poor. This poverty adds strength to the rebels. Gbenro Olajiobi is a human security manager at Action Aid, a poverty-fighting group. He says better security is needed if the government plans to use non-military methods against Boko Haram. He says people are in an insecure environment. Economics has collapsed. Rights have collapsed. There is an intrusion of fear. And he says he thinks the best thing to do is to stabilize the country a bit. The United Nations has called the Boko Haram insurgency increasingly monstrous. UN officials say almost 500,000 people have fled their homes, and tens of thousands have fled to neighboring countries. Farmers have left their fields. The lack of crops has threatened food security in many areas. The sparks are flying on Capitol Hill. That means there is a dispute going on. That's nothing new. But this time, it's between the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and a committee of the United States Senate. The question is, will this dispute affect U.S. intelligence operations overseas? Mario Ritter explains a puzzling situation.
Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Dianne Feinstein made news last week. She said the CIA had watched aides to committee members who were investigating the agency's methods.
I have grave concerns that the CIA's search may well have violated the separation of powers principles embodied in the United States Constitution.
In 2009, the Central Intelligence Agency let committee staff members use its computers to study secret documents. These records told about the CIA's questioning and detention of terrorism suspects during the presidency of George W. Bush. The agency said the staff members had taken documents they were not meant to have. Senator Feinstein said the agency then blocked the use of those documents. CIA Director John Brennan has denied that any break-in to computer files or hacking took place.
I think a lot of people who are claiming that there has been this tremendous sort of spying and monitoring and hacking will be proved wrong.
President Barack Obama has called for the public release of the committee's secret report on the CIA detention and interrogation program. Some lawmakers say the report describes the use of waterboarding, a method of questioning detainees, during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Professor Henry Farrell of George Washington University says the report could damage the CIA's public image around the world.
But I think at the very least we're going to see some embarrassment for the United States when some of the stuff that the CIA was in fact doing in the first years after September 11th are revealed publicly, and that's going to, I think, be quite controversial in other countries.
But Professor Farrell says world leaders are not likely to be concerned about the dispute between the Senate and the CIA. Mark Lowenthal agrees. He is president of the Intelligence and Security Academy. He says all countries that work with the United States know there is a system of congressional oversight.
All the countries with whom we work know that we have a congressional oversight system and that certain materials are given to the House and Senate as part of their oversight. So the fact that this is going on is probably not going to be news to anybody, and so I don't think it'll affect those relationships.
He also says the dispute may show the value of the American system of government.
This is how you run a secret intelligence community in a democracy, that there are rules and there's give and take, and that the intelligence community is not just doing things on their own.
This is
an election year in the United States. The Republican Party could claim a majority in the Senate in November. A Republican senator would lead the Intelligence Committee if that happens. And Republicans have not shown that they want the report on CIA interrogation methods made public. I'm Mario Ritter.
Thank you, Mario. Now, won't it be interesting to see who wins that one? It's almost time for us to move aside for some more Learning English programs and world news at the beginning of the hour. But before we do, here are some things going on in the United States. Even though there is still snow on the ground, the National Cherry Blossom Festival begins. Millions of people from around the world come to Washington, D.C. to welcome spring and see the beautiful trees near the Lincoln and Jefferson memorials. Up in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, folks will be reading poetry aloud, drinking special drinks, and even burning a snowman to say goodbye to winter and hello spring. It's time for me to run, so let's agree to get together again tomorrow, right here at the same time. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington, and this is VOA.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. Last week, we reported about community colleges in the United States. Some educators say these two-year colleges may be a good choice for international students who have finished secondary school and want to study in America. Today, we tell about a program at some American community colleges for students from several nations. It is called the Community College Initiative Program. It lasts 1 year. It is for students from areas underserved in education and skills training. Since 2007, about 2,100 students from 16 nations have taken part in the program. The Bureau of Educational Affairs of the United States State Department provides for their needs. Three consortia, or organizations, of community colleges administer the program with the Bureau of Educational Affairs. Schools across the country take part. Sider Rahman is project director of the Community College Consortium led by Northern Virginia Community College. He says United States community colleges offer possibilities for foreign students whose governments cannot do so. He says many students in poor, rural areas do not have an equal chance to succeed. They have fewer resources than students in big cities.
So there are many students who don't have opportunities like those who are in some of the major cities. They are underserved by the government in education, in health, in services like opportunities for entrepreneurship. So that's what is meant by underserved. So one of the unique aspects of the U.S., and more so in terms of the Community College Initiative Program, is to reach out to those kids to see if, given the opportunity, that they also will excel.
At the start of their stay in America, students deepen their knowledge of English and learn about their school's surroundings. They have several fields of study to choose from, including information technology, business administration, and agriculture. Other areas open to them include the hotel and visitors industries, media and journalism, engineering, and health. Students attend classes and study at school, but they also are active in other school activities. They hold internships at businesses and nonprofit organizations. Program members at Muscatine Community College in Iowa are a good example. They can complete internships at businesses from local farms to large companies. Students also give presentations about their countries to other students and to local communities, and they do many hours of community service. At Miami-Dade College in Florida this year, Community College Initiative Program students took part in the Martin Luther King Jr. Day of National Service. You can get more information about the program from the Public Affairs section of the United States Embassy in your country. That's the Education Report from VOA Learning English. For more stories about education, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Geraldine Watson.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program about American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. Andrew Jackson was nearing the end of his presidency. He had served 2 terms. For many Americans, Jackson remained incredibly popular. They liked that a poor boy from the frontier, who could barely read and write, grew up to become president. Historian Daniel Feller is an expert on Andrew Jackson. He calls the president and war hero the ultimate American self-made man.
He's a quintessentially American figure. You can't imagine anybody like this getting to be the head of a country at that time, certainly anywhere else but in the United States. And even in the United States, it would have been unheard of just a few years before.
Daniel Feller says Jackson often used government to help ordinary people instead of the rich and powerful. For this reason, many called him the people's president. But not everyone agreed. His opponents said, "Tyrants have always spoken in the name of the people." They said Jackson used his popularity to do whatever he wanted, whether it was legal or not. His opponents in Congress even denounced him with a censure resolution for not releasing some of his papers to the government. They called him King Andrew. Many American Indians called Jackson yet another name. They called him Jackson the Devil. Jackson wanted Native Americans in southern states, including Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee, to move west. Jackson did not think it was right for Indian tribes to exist as independent nations within the United States. And white voters wanted Indians' land for farming. Historian Daniel Feller points out that the United States government had tried to get Indians to move away from white settlements for a long time, long before Jackson became president.
But Jackson brought an urgency to it that none of his predecessors had. Quincy Adams and Monroe had endeavored to remove Indians when Indians seemed to be willing to be removed. Jackson took the position that they need to be removed now.
In 1830, Jackson pushed a bill through Congress called the Indian Removal Act. The bill allowed him to create new Indian homelands in the Oklahoma Territory, an area west of the Mississippi River where few white Americans lived at the time. The federal government would essentially trade the Indians their old land for the new land and pay for tribes to move west permanently.
He managed to convince himself, and I think that's the best way to put it, that he was actually doing the Indians a favor, that Indian tribes that remained in proximity to whites simply disintegrated. Their tribal structure, their national structure disintegrated. They died.
Daniel Feller says just because Jackson believed he was helping the Indians did not mean he did not benefit from their removal or that he was right. Besides, the Indians did not have much choice. Jackson told them that if they did not accept his offer, their nations would be controlled by the American government. The Chickasaw, Choctaw, and Creeks agreed under pressure. The Cherokees resisted. They even took their case to the Supreme Court, which agreed that the Indians were independent from state authority. But Jackson and the state of Georgia ignored the Supreme Court's decision. Eventually, soldiers forced the Cherokees from their homes and marched them over 1,600 kilometers to Oklahoma. More than 5,000 died. The forced march later became known as the Trail of Tears. Even the Indians who survived continued to suffer. The United States government did not meet the terms of the treaty. Few Indians were paid for their goods. Most were not given food and other supplies during the journey or when they arrived in Oklahoma. Daniel Feller notes that the United States has a long history of defaulting on its treaties with Indian nations, both before and after Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson might not have intended for the Indians to suffer so much, but he did not lead his government to respect and protect them either.
There are many who regard Jackson as being the kind of epitome, the exemplar, the personification of everything that has been wrong, not only regrettable, but perhaps evil, in white America's treatment of the Indians.
Daniel Feller says Jackson's treatment of the Native Americans, along with some of his other actions, complicates his image as an American hero.
If you look at Jackson's own personal rise, it's a pretty impressive rise. It leaves a lot of dead people and a lot of displaced or abused populations behind it, including Indians, including slaves, including personally the people he shot. So, again, it's a complicated image. It shows this American character in both, you might say, its best and its most disturbing light at the same time.
In 1836, the American public voted for their next president. Andrew Jackson had served for 8 years. He did not want another term. He supported his vice president, Martin Van Buren. Van Buren had been very close to the outgoing president. In the election of 1828, Van Buren had been successful in forming a strong political alliance. This alliance helped put Jackson in the White House. Jackson was grateful for Van Buren's help and asked him to come to Washington to serve as Secretary of State. Van Buren quickly became the most powerful man in Jackson's cabinet. He was able to help Jackson in negotiations with Britain and France. But his greatest help was in building a strong political party for Jackson. Van Buren built up the Democratic Party by removing people from government jobs if they had not supported Jackson. These jobs were then given to those who had supported the president. Ultimately, it was the Democratic Party that gave Jackson wide support for his policies. Van Buren served as Jackson's Secretary of State for 2 years. By this time, Jackson had decided that Van Buren would be the best man to follow him as president. Jackson offered to resign after the 1832 elections and give Van Buren the job of president. Van Buren rejected the offer. He said he wanted to be elected by the people, but he agreed to be Jackson's vice president in 1832. 4 years later, at Jackson's request, the Democrats chose Van Buren to be their presidential candidate. Several candidates from the newly formed Whig Party opposed him, but the Whigs were divided, and Van Buren easily won the election. March 4, 1837 was a bright, cold day. The winter sun shone over the crowd that had gathered in Washington to watch the swearing-in of the new president. Andrew Jackson left the White House in the presidential carriage, riding beside Martin Van Buren. It was the first time a president and a president-elect rode to the Capitol together for the inauguration. The big crowd on the east side of the Capitol grew quiet when Jackson and Van Buren walked up the steps of the building. After Chief Justice Roger Taney swore in President Van Buren, the new president gave his inaugural speech. Then Andrew Jackson started slowly down the steps. A mighty cheer burst from the crowd. "For once," wrote Senator Thomas Hart Benton, an ally of Jackson, "the rising sun was eclipsed by the setting sun." The day after Van Buren became president, Jackson met with a few of his friends. Frank Blair, the editor of Jackson's newspaper, was one of them. Senator Benton was another. It was a warm, friendly meeting. They thought back over Jackson's years in the White House and talked about what had been done. Jackson said he thought his best piece of work was getting rid of the Bank of the United States. He said he had saved the people from a monopoly of a few rich men. Someone asked about Texas. Jackson said he was not worried about Texas. That problem would solve itself, he said. Did he have any regrets about anything? "Only two," said Jackson. "I regret I was unable to shoot Henry Clay or to hang John C. Calhoun." The next morning, March 6th, Jackson left Washington to return to his home in Tennessee. Jackson was to leave the Capitol by train. Thousands of people lined the streets to the train station, waiting for a last look at their president. Jackson stood in the open air on the rear platform of the train. His hat was off, and the wind blew through his long white hair. The locomotive bell rang, there was a hiss of steam, and the train began to move. Jackson bowed. One man who was there said it was as if a bright star had gone out of the sky. Jackson lived for 8 more years. He read as many as 20 different newspapers, exchanged letters with many people in government, and spent time with his son and grandchildren. But Jackson's health had never been very good. He had been shot many years before, and the gunshot wounds created problems. Andrew Jackson died at home on June 8, 1845. He was 78 years old. Back in Washington, Martin Van Buren continued Jackson's legacy by carrying out many of his policies. Van Buren and his government will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.